Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. We're broadcasting live from the Republican National Non-Convention. Justin Ewan here, Mike Borges, and you know, Chris Rosen there in New York. Everybody, it's all working, guys.
It's all good.
And we're on the air. Yeah, it's a fine thing. Here we are at the RNC, and some very interesting buzz going around. The RNC has decided not to have any political speeches today that would mention the names of John McCain or Sarah Palin. Now, just think about that for a minute. No political speeches that would mention the names of the nominees. They're going to do some, you know, pro forma stuff. They've got, by the rules of the convention, they have to actually have meetings. They have to have quorums. They have to have people get together and say, yes, we're here. The equivalent of a board of directors meeting kind of thing. You know, they got to do that stuff. But there's going to be nothing mentioning their names. No press events. No speeches. Everything's been called off. Why? Because of a hurricane? I would think that if a hurricane was happening, and in fact it is, and it was going to be, you know, a terrible, disastrous thing.
Yeah, how you doing?
And that they would instead be saying, let's use, you know, gently, appropriately, let's use this thing for political advantage. I mean, it's not like the Republicans didn't do that with, like, the war in Iraq or, like, 9/11. I mean, think how many times 9/11 was mentioned. It got to the point where Rudy Giuliani was, it's a noun and it's a verb in 9/11, right? So you would think that, I mean, if I was a strategist with the Republican National Committee, by the way, our telephone number, 866-303-2270, I'm guessing we're going to be pretty light on guests today because there's nobody here. It's a non-convention. It's the convention that's not the convention. So, Eddie, I would guess, and TomHartman.com, I'll be getting into the chat room here during the next break. It's we just set up. And of course, AirAmerica.com, we've got the live webcam going. Hi there, guys. I would guess, if I was a Republican strategy, here's the math that I'd be doing in my head. If I was a Republican strategist, I would be saying, here's our opportunity to introduce the Republican compassion. You know, just the fact that the Republican, compassionate conservatism, to take the first day of the convention and turn it into a fundraiser for people. To take the first day of the convention and feature the people who in the past, not, obviously not the people who are doing the work right now, you don't want to distract them from what they're doing down there in New Orleans and all around, you know, in the Gulf Coast, but to get the people out there talking about, you know, this is what can you do, Republicans all around the country, to help out? How can we be best prepared? Let's show the face of good government. Let's do those things that the Republicans, frankly, need to do. But no, they've chosen instead to say, we're not going to have any events that are going to discuss the names of the president or the vice president. Maybe they'll discuss the name of the president, but not the vice president. Which brings us to the speculation. Why is this? Could it be that Sarah Palin is going to be the Tom Eagleton candidate? That, you know, a day from now she won't be the candidate? And if so, why? Could it be that it has to do with Troopergate? with her brother-in-law. You know, her putting all kinds of pressure on people to fire her brother-in-law. And you know, we're starting to get some of these kind of seamy, untoward stories about the way that she's run the office of the governor. This is a woman who takes no prisoners. She's in the George W. Bush tradition. You know, the Karl Rove tradition. Don't just get rid of your enemies. I mean, don't just, like, you know, get them out of your way or get them out of the police. Destroy them. Or maybe it has to do with her judgment with regard to her last child. She's 44 years old. She's an Alaskan. She's in Texas, 7.5 months pregnant with a child with Down syndrome. And her water breaks, or starts leaking anyway. Now, speaking as the father of three children, and I have some knowledge of this. Our middle child was a home birth. I actually delivered our second child, and Louise would tell you, my wife would tell you that I didn't deliver him. She delivered him. I caught him, and she's right. She did the hard work. And also delivered our third child with a midwife in a birthing center. I know that when this is just my experience, but my experience has been that A, the more babies you have, the quicker they come, and B, that when you start leaking water, you get to the hospital as fast as you, and you're having contractions, you get to the hospital as fast as you can. So Sarah's down in Texas, and she says she's having contractions and she's leaking, but she decides to stay and give a speech rather than going to the hospital. After the speech, now, keep in mind, the sac that surrounds the baby is, you know, fluid-filled, which is protecting the baby. And if you get in an airplane and the pressure starts changing, it's like, you know, have you ever gotten in an airplane with a bottle where, you know, back in the days when you could, where the top wasn't on quite tight enough, or with something in your suitcase, you know, a cologne or perfume bottle or something like that, where the top wasn't on quite tight enough and it all leaked out because the pressure changes? I mean, when pressure changes around liquids, it can be really dangerous. But she not just gets on an airplane, she gets on two airplanes. Goes through the airport in Seattle, all the way up to Anchorage. Biggest city in Alaska, best hospital, neonatal unit, because we're talking a preemie here. And it's been 13 hours since her water broke. What does she do? You'd think, you know, head right to the hospital. But no, she instead gets in a car, has her husband drive her 45 minutes to a little out-of-the-way hospital in the town that she used to be the mayor of, that, oddly enough, today on their website does not list her giving birth there the day, April 18th, the day that this happened. Or was it March 18th? I believe it was April 18th. Which is causing a lot of people to scratch their heads about the judgment of a woman who would do that. Or was there something else involved? There was some reference to this on our program Friday when we had the program director of Kudo, our affiliate in Alaska, in Anchorage, Alaska, on, who also does the morning show, who said, you know, everybody in Alaska knows that there's more to this than meets the eye. It is raging through the blogosphere. A post over at the Daily Kos that is now on the front page of Michael Moore's website at michaelmoore.com. And Drudge has weighed in, and Town Hall has weighed in. And you know, the subtext of this is, was she actually pregnant? Would an actually pregnant 44-year-old woman who is leaking actually do all those things? Or was she covering up for somebody else? And this is where it gets really dangerous. And it's really dangerous, I think, in two ways for Democrats to even get near this. And no Democrats are touching this. But it gets dangerous, one, nobody, including me, wants to be picking on or even, frankly, naming a 16-year-old kid, her daughter. And I'm not going to name her, and we'll just leave it at that. And number two, it could blow back. Let's say that she is covering for her daughter's pregnancy. Might she get enormous sympathy for that? Might this actually work to their advantage? I don't know. Or could it? Or could this? But anyhow, the reason I started this whole thing about how the Republicans, you would think, would be using the hurricane to their advantage rather than calling off their convention today is because the buzz behind the buzz behind the buzz, the rumor mill here, the Republican rumor mill that I'm hearing, that I've heard from more than one person, is that the reason why this convention got called off today had nothing to do with the hurricane. It had to do with the fact that this blogosphere stuff about Sarah Palin, completely blindsided them. They're freaked out. They're trying to vet her now. At the same time, the National Enquirer has a reporter up in Alaska with a pocket full of cash running around. There may or may not be a story here. It almost doesn't matter. It's just they're in full freakout mode. And so they shut down the convention for 24 hours, basically, until they could figure out what the hell's going on. And, you know, that's what they're trying to do, which just puts a whole interesting face on this whole thing. And I'd love to hear your thoughts on this. The other thing that I want to be sure to mention, I'll talk about when we come back, and then we'll take your calls at 866-303-2270, is the police here in Minneapolis have been doing preemptive raids. They're busting into people's houses, kicking down their doors, finding nothing. It's like police state.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I want to get into this police raid for just a second here, and then we'll pick up your calls. Ramsey County authorities, this is from the Star Tribune, the local paper here, Minneapolis-St. Paul. Ramsey County authorities conducted raids across Minneapolis and St. Paul Friday and Saturday as a preemptive strike against disruptive protests of the Republican National Convention. Now, wait a minute. A preemptive strike? I thought in this country we arrested people for doing things, not thinking about things. Or not planning things. Now, I suppose that, you know, there are conspiracy laws. And conspiracy to commit a crime is a crime. But is there evidence that people were actually conspiring to commit crimes? They're asserting that they were conspiring to peacefully protest. Five people were arrested. More than 100 were handcuffed, questioned, and released by scores of deputies and police officers, according to police and elected officials familiar with the raid. And, you know, it goes on. 35 self-described anarchists, right? This is what the Ramsey County Sheriff Bob Fletcher says they were going after. He says, these acts included tactics to blockade and disable delegate buses, breach venue security, and injure police officers. They got a gas mask. Oh, yeah, that's definitely dangerous stuff. They found axes and slingshots. Maybe they just happened to be around the house. Buckets of urine they found. Well, it turned out, actually, the local TV, I saw this last night on the local TV, there was a guy living in a garage behind the house, and he didn't have a bathroom. And it had nothing to do with this. I mean, this is just absolutely bizarre. By the way, it is also Labor Day. Some statistics from the Associated Press, more than 10% today, Labor Day. I'll be speaking, in fact, this afternoon at an SEIU gig here. At around 5-something, I'm going to be speaking briefly at the SEIU gig here in Minneapolis. Our program, by the way, brought to you in part by the Service Employees International Union, SEIU.org. And let me get that plug in because we're very, very proud to have them sponsor our show in part. More than 10% of Americans are unemployed, discouraged from seeking work, or underemployed. That is a 25% increase from 1 year ago. Nearly 530,000 Americans were subject to mass layoffs in the past year, up nearly 5%. The median weekly earnings for American workers has not grown in real terms since George Bush came into office. At $6.55, the federal minimum wage is worth 40 cents less per hour in inflation-adjusted dollars than it was a decade ago. And about 4% of the workforce wants to work full-time but can't find full-time work. I mean, you tell me, as John McCain said, well, the fundamentals are solid. Everything's okay. You know, we're having a great time. This, a letter, by the way, this from Robert Alberti in Minneapolis. He wrote a letter to the editor of the Star Tribune. I believe this is from the Star Tribune. I have the clip, but not the whole paper. And here's his letter. It's just two paragraphs. I'll share it with you. Tim Pawlenty, of course, is the governor of the state. Here we are broadcasting from Minneapolis. He says, for years, Minnesota has sacrificed for Governor Tim Pawlenty. When our roads and bridges decayed, it was so GOP leaders would know Pawlenty was a good conservative foot soldier. When state funds to cities were cut, it was so Pawlenty could demonstrate his conservative bona fides to Beltway Republicans. When education funds were slashed, it was so that Pawlenty could prove he was ready to be a vice presidential candidate. Now Pawlenty is not John McCain's vice presidential pick. So why has Minnesota sacrificed so much on behalf of Tim Pawlenty's failed ambitions? Interesting question. And let me, by the way, just shout out to our listeners on AM 950 KTNF, the voice of Minnesota. And so, so pleased to be here. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. There's a lot of topics on the table here, not to mention, you know, the hurricane, not to mention the you know, are we going to have a war in Iran? I mean, is that what's coming up next? I mean, there's just so much going on. Mike in Idaho. Hey, Mike, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Happy Labor Day to you.
Thank you. Happy Labor Day to you too, Mike.
You bet. Hey, I want to let you know I'm a board-certified emergency physician practicing here in Idaho, and I have an interesting opinion about what's going on with Sarah and this baby she was delivering. It may have been, as you suggested, that she was covering for her daughter who was delivering out of wedlock. But I think a more plausible explanation may be that that a woman like this was actually trying to lose this pregnancy, that she and her husband undoubtedly knew that this child was Down syndrome. And as you know, Down syndrome children, there's a spectrum. Some can be fairly high functioning, some can be very low functioning and have significant medical problems, heart defects, gut defects, etc. And I wonder if, you know, she was trying to lose this pregnancy. Because as a physician, if a woman like this wandered into my emergency room saying, I'm pregnant, I think I'm in labor, I think that my water may have broken, that person would be admitted, no questions. She'd be put on bed rest, strict monitoring. They would try everything they could to sort of catch that leak and monitor the baby very closely. For her to give a speech, get on a plane, where, by the way, if she was at pressure, she wouldn't really have to worry about increased pressure leakage, decreased pressure causing more leakage, but if she went into labor on the plane and delivered a very premature infant,
baby,
she would definitely probably lose the baby. So to go all this way, and the flight, of course, from Texas to Alaska is probably 12 hours. And
yeah,
then to get
it's 11 hours.
Drive,
that's a very grim assessment, Mike. But
yeah, and, I mean, I guess
we got to wrap it up. Thank you very much.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
I climbed across the mountain tops, swam all across the ocean blue, across all the land and I rode for you, and baby I brought them all for you.
34 minutes past the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. By the way, just the story, CBS News is reporting. Oops, excuse me, somebody just tossed a window at me, and I just lost the story. The wonders of chat, right? Here we go. Let me get back to it. Okay, Republican Vice President, this is CBS reporting. Republican Vice Presidential candidate Sarah Palin confirmed Monday that her 17-year-old daughter is pregnant. Bristol Palin is 5 months pregnant and is going to marry the father, the Palin said in a statement released by the McCain campaign. Monday's announcement was intended to knock down Internet rumors that Palin faked her own pregnancy with son Trigg, who was born in April with Down syndrome, to cover up for her daughter Bristol. The plot thickens. You know, this is, this, in the grand scheme of things, I got to say, this is trivial stuff, except as it may speak to the judgment of somebody. But anyhow, Andrew Langer is with us. He's the president of the Institute for Liberty. Let's get into some economic stuff.
Thanks
here.
Thanks for having me on.
Hey, Andrew, great to have you here with us.
Good to be here.
InstituteForLiberty.org
yes.
is the website. A longtime fighter for small business, which is near and dear to my heart. I've been the founder and CEO of a number of small businesses. And
there you go.
Done very well with them over the years.
And when we talk about small business, we're talking about really small businesses. We're talking about businesses with 20 or fewer employees.
Yeah.
So really the 90% of businesses that are out there that are faced with all sorts of different struggles that are heartily different from their big business brethren.
Yeah. Well, I, you know, 20 or fewer employees, I would probably put a threshold at more like 50 because, you know, it's...
Well, sure. I mean, you can do that and it encompasses. But the thing is, I spent 6 years working for the nation's largest small business association and came to the realization, you know, the research of their foundation found that really you get above 35 and things start to change. You get above 35 employees and you hire your first sort of regulatory professionals, which is sort of my background and wheelhouse, the myriad little things that government does that sort of slap in the face of small businesses. But 20 or fewer, that number comes from not just the 90% of businesses that are out there, but the Small Business Administration's Office of Advocacy recognizes that regulatory costs for those businesses, you know, drop precipitously when you get above 20 employees. The economies of scale that happen, you depending on the business you're in, you hire those regulatory professionals. So really, you know, I focus on those because you're talking about businesses that generally it's the business owner, the business owner's spouse, or
right.
somebody.
These are usually sub-S corporations.
Yeah, a lot of them are S corporations. You know, we're talking about mom and pops, and they, you know, they're the ones who are trying to figure out what they need to do to stay in compliance with the law, and it's really hard for them to do it. So that's really, I left the other organization and came over and took over and took over IFL because I saw that. In terms of sort of D.C. research and advocacy, there are a lot of organizations which focus on small business, but various aspects of it. And there are a lot of organizations that focus on the Congress. Nobody focuses on the federal executive branch. And really where the rubber hits the road on a daily basis, that's what small business owners are dealing with. It's the rules and regulations that come out of the federal executive branch.
We've had a situation in America, again, speaking as an entrepreneur, as a businessman myself, we've had a situation in the United States where in 1980, and maybe you're not old enough to remember this, I don't know, but in 1980, if you walked into any strip mall in America, three-quarters of the businesses were locally owned.
Sure.
And today, if you walk into, and you could parachute into any city in America and within 5 minutes know where you were because the local hotels were all locally owned,
sure.
the local diners, and they all had the town name on them. Today, if you were to get thrown out of a plane at 100,000 feet and land anywhere in America, you'd have no idea where you are because you'd see an olive tree, you'd see a Holiday Inn, you'd see...
I am a foodie. I'm a big-time foodie, and everybody who knows me knows this. And so it's very dismaying, you know, when I go into a city and I see, you know, the Fuddruckers, the Applebee's, or
the chain,
called Applebee's, the chain restaurant.
Now, this all began with Ronald Reagan in 81 and 82 stopping, for all practical purposes, the enforcement of the Sherman Antitrust Act. And Jimmy Carter had busted up AT&T, and that was the end of it.
Well, I mean, you know, I look at it from a slightly different perspective. I mean, to me, it's, you know, I think in the 80s you had a lot of big businesses that realized that they could take on increasing amounts of regulation and drive their smaller competitors out of business. A guy named Tim Carney wrote a great book about this a couple years ago. I can't think of the title offhand. But essentially, you know, you get, and I was on the losing end of this with an OSHA issue a few years back where, if you can believe it, not the Kodak, the Eastman Chemical was in a coalition with some of the bigger labor unions and some other big business groups to bring on an increasing amount of regulation out of OSHA because they knew that they could drive all of the smaller specialty manufacturers out of business. And that's what happens, is that these guys recognize that their economies of scale make it so that they can, because they have the full-time regulatory.
But those are the rare exceptions. I mean, the vast majority of small businesses.
No, it really isn't the rare exception. I mean, you know, you're talking about situations, you know, with the small businesses, the locally owned restaurants, where the mega chains, they have the folks on staff who can call for increasing amounts of federal labor regulation and really do things that bring on increasing costs to these smaller businesses so that they are actually driven under. It can happen whether or not you are a small hotel operator, you know, an independent hotel operator who's having to deal with the Americans with Disabilities.
There's a very easy solution to that. if that's the problem, the very easy solution is for small business to get together and pool their resources to share cooperatively somebody who can deal with regulators.
Well, and that's
the fact of the matter is that when a Walmart moves into a community, on average, 100 local small businesses go out of business.
Yeah, you get an argument for me about the impact of it. And the fact is that Walmart, of course, you know, one of my big issues, both when I was working as a lobbyist in D.C. and now with the think tank, is this eminent domain issue, which to me puts the small businesses at an incredible
disadvantage. Well, it's not just eminent domain. I mean, Walmart's actually using the Fourth Amendment, the 14th Amendment. They're claiming that they're a person under the Constitution. They're being discriminated against.
Well, I mean, the thing is, you know, I always come back to when folks talk about that issue of whether or not corporations are persons for the purposes of constitutional rights. So long as, you know, corporations are going to be litigated against in the same manner as individuals are and held accountable in the same way, and folks in corporations.
But you can't charge a corporation with murder.
No, but you can charge individuals within that corporation with various acts.
That's a
different
thing.
But in terms of like but it's
corporations. Up until 1886, corporations were called corporate persons, and individuals were called human persons.
And then you get into a whole issues where getting back to the private property rights issue, which is a big one for me. You know, corporations, if they can own property and government can take that private property away, I mean, clearly they have some rights in that regard. You can't sort of willy nilly.
Sure. There is always in common law there has always been a status for corporations, churches, and other groups that pay, so that they can pay taxes, own property, and involve themselves in litigation.
Yeah, and as government,
appropriately so. But should they be able to accumulate wealth in perpetuity? I mean, up until the 1890s, every state in the union said that no corporation can exist more than 40 years. That was the maximum.
No.
Some states it was 20 or 30 years because nobody wanted. The founders were very clear. Jefferson talked about this. He never wanted to see a landed gentry emerge in the United States, and they were very concerned that the corporate form could do that. And that's what we have now. You know, ever since the charter mongering.
I don't know. I got to tell you. Listen, I go back to. I've got a. There's a business in D.C. that I go to all the time. And I'm sorry, my buddy just walked away. It's there's a restaurant in D.C. family owned and operated called Ben's Chili Bowl. And last weekend they just celebrated their 50th anniversary. And the two founders, Ben and Virginia Ali, have passed the restaurant on to their sons. And the sons run it in the same way that their parents did. And I'd hate to see a situation where an institution like that within a community, simply because it's a corporation, would have to be dissolved because it lasts less than 40
years. If
that's
a sub-S corporation, they don't have to dissolve it.
Well, I don't know exactly how they've formed it, but the fact is...
And the way the corporations traditionally were dissolved was you dissolve the assets and then you rebuy them the next day.
But the point is that it is
subject to the oversight of the community.
But that's just it. I mean, once you start sort of going down that road of sort of the community sort of injecting its opinion on things, you know.
But the flip side of that is when you go down the road of allowing corporations who are not persons, they can live forever. They can own others of their own type. They can clone themselves instantly. These are things that human beings can't do. They feel no pain. It doesn't matter if the air is polluted. It doesn't matter if the water is toxic. A corporation is not affected by any of those things.
Again,
and when you say corporations, should have rights under the Constitution.
But corporations do have. I mean, they do have. There are certain measures of accountability, at least there can be. And when they don't, that's when the regulatory state does step in. But you do have to remember in that within these corporations there are people who do work. They do live in the communities in which they are working. And there are sort of consequences to their actions.
How
in terms
can
of
John McCain's policies of perpetuating Reagan's policies of not enforcing the Sherman Act, of allowing... I mean, we have... Name an industry in the United States that's not dominated by fewer than seven companies.
I can't offhand, but that doesn't mean that there are.
But the point is, if you were to go back 25, 30 years ago before Reagan... You could look at any industry in the United States and not find that they're dominated by just.
I just,
two or
Tom, I think it's folly to think that that a John McCain administration, simply because John McCain might be on the wrong side of the position that you think in terms of antitrust, that John McCain is going to be somehow anti-regulatory. I mean, you know, I am bracing no matter what happens in January for an increase in regulation on a whole host of fronts. You know, no matter who becomes president, John McCain or Barack Obama, and I come back to the fact that no matter what happens,
so let's build co-ops for small businesses, or is that what you're doing? We're talking with Andrew Langer, the Institute of Liberty, InstituteForLiberty.org is the website.
Well, I don't know about co-ops per se. I mean, we're working on a number of good tools for small businesses to use. I've been working on something called business.gov for a number of years, which is a website, a one-stop shop that down the road. we're hoping that a business can type in a few key identifying pieces of information about what kind of business it's in, how many employees it has, where it's located, and it'll spit out the regulations that it needs to comply with. But the problem is you're talking about a code of federal regulations that's 14,000 pages long. You've got just, you know, so many regulations that are out there that is, you know, even the most seasoned regulatory and pro-regulatory professionals recognize that nobody can be in compliance with 100% of regulations 100% of the time.
Sure.
And when you're talking about things like environmental regulations, where there are huge criminal penalties that accrue, you know, then you've got an issue where the science or requirement, the knowledge that you're doing is wrong, you know, the stakes are raised considerably.
Yeah. Well, I'd love to see more tools for small businesses, and I'd love to see this depoliticized somewhat, because small business is the heart and soul of this country. It really is. Andrew Langer, InstituteForLiberty.org. Thanks, Andrew.
Thanks, Tom.
Good talking to you. 45 minutes past. Back to your calls.
The Tom Hartman Program. Visit us on the web at HartmanRadio.com.
Our telephone number, and it's I find this fascinating. I mean, there's a lot of stuff on the table, from police state tactics here in Minneapolis, really quite shocking. I mean, going into people's homes and taking them down because they're planning a peaceful protest. From that to the fact that there's a hurricane hitting the Gulf Coast right now. And although it seems to have moderated somewhat, this is still a disaster, and it killed a whole bunch of people on its way here, particularly in Haiti. To the question of why is it that the Republicans actually decided to shut down their convention? What's the deal? What's the deal? Let's pick up your calls. Lou in Coral Springs, Florida. Hey, Lou, what's up? Lou, you're
Hello?
On the air.
Hey. Yes, sir. How you doing, sir?
Just fine.
Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment about Sarah Palin. What bothers me the most is not the chanting or anything like that. It's the fact that the very first chance she got to introduce herself to the American public, she lied to us. There are reports.
Are you talking about the Bridge to Nowhere? She said she was against it when she had been a big supporter of it?
Yeah. So... Yeah. We had 8 years of government lying and misusing the powers of their office. I don't think we really need more of that.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. It's a good point, Lou. Thank you very much for the call. From Lou to Lou. Lou in New Jersey. Hey, Lou.
Hi, Tom. I was thinking maybe this is some sort of Karl Rove dirty trick, sending out false information. So. He can say, well, this is what the Democrats trying to accuse her of, this, that, and the other thing. You know
it's not inconceivable. Keep in mind, Karl Rove bugged his own office so that he could claim he was working for a guy who was running for governor. This is before Bush was governor of Texas, who was running for governor of Texas. And the Democrat was ahead. And Karl Rove found a bug behind his desk. And he called a press conference and just went on this whole hissy fit about it and pointed the finger at the Democrat. The Democrat had nothing to do with it. It was later discovered that the bug had like a 3-hour battery life, and it was just, you know, something that had been hastily tossed up there. Obviously, Rove put it there, but it caused his guy to win the election. So, you know, I wouldn't put it past him. I wouldn't put it past him. Anything is possible, Lou. Absolutely anything is possible. Chance in Marietta, California. Hey, Chance.
Hello?
Hi, you're on the air.
Oh, yeah. My name is Charisse, by the way.
Charisse. I'm sorry.
Yeah. What I'm calling for, Tom, is that I just read an article on the Anchorage Daily News, ADN.com, and they have, I know this has been out for a long time, but Palin picked a Canadian company for the American gas line. And the
that's very Republican of her.
I'm sorry?
That's very Republican of her.
Yeah.
They're giving tax breaks right now to companies that offshore jobs here.
Yeah, and you know what? The American people are going to have to pay $500 million in seed money for this, for our just so this company can do the drilling on in America. So, you know, I'm not really you've inspired me to do a lot of research, and I'm just starting to do a lot of research, and I'm going through all the blogs and all the newspapers, and that's just something I found, and I'm just you know, Exxon owns that part of the land that's going to be drilled upon.
Yeah. Yeah, at the bottom line, regardless of babies or pregnancies or anything else, this woman is the same old. She's McSame also. You know, it's the same old, same old. She's Trent Lott in a dress. It's you know, in terms of policies, it's, you know, go for the oil companies, kill the bears and the wolves, you know, despoil the environment, and by the way, get revenge on your enemies, you know, very, very quickly. Cherise, thanks a lot for the call. Bonnie in Burgettstown, Pennsylvania. Hey, Bonnie.
Well, happy Labor Day, and my thoughts are with the people of Haiti and people on the Gulf Coast. I'm sure a lot of our listeners agree with me. So you read something about the latest news is about Palin's pregnancy.
CBS just broke the story. Now, of course, we broke the story Friday on this show. We had the program director and morning host of our affiliate in Alaska, KUDO, who came on and said that Sarah Palin's daughter was pregnant.
So she's admitting that she lied.
Well, no, this isn't the whose baby was Trey. This is that her daughter is pregnant right now.
We
were actually, wanted to put that story up on the homepage of Air America, and then we thought, you know, it's a kid, you know, it might be wrong. It's innuendo. We're not gonna, you know. So I really didn't go any farther with it. I let that person say what they said because people say what they say. But I didn't push it. But CBS has now confirmed this. The campaign has now confirmed it. So
okay. Well, as an aside, Palin kills wolves from gas guzzling helicopters. That is not hunting. And I would like to make a preemptive strike myself and defend Barack Obama's community organizing experience. The cons are already scaring their prejudiced followers to reductively define community organizing as voter registration, and that touches off their fears of voter fraud. So my inoculation against that malarkey is that I can't think of a more American immoral action than encouraging fellow Americans to participate in voting, a right that many people fought and died for. And I'm more concerned about African Americans being caged again and again being made to stand in line for hours to vote. And since when did the cons ever have respect for the people that Obama organized? Cons would rather they remain disempowered.
And it wasn't just black people that Barack Obama was organizing, by the way.
Correct.
A lot of white people on the south side of Chicago.
That's a very good point.
Although I guarantee you, the way the Republicans are going to spin it is he was getting the black folks together.
Oh, yes.
You know, look out, be aware, be wary. And this is just, you know, the race card again. Roger Ailes was helping Richard Nixon do it in 68. You know, it's been going on ever since. It's one of the favorite Republican strategies is divide and conquer, and particularly divide along racial lines. Bonnie, thanks a lot for the call. Always great to hear from you. It's the top of the hour. It's 57 minutes past the hour. We'll be back with more of the Tom Hartman program live from Minneapolis, St. Paul. We're actually in St. Paul. And I believe Justin?
Yeah. I have no idea.
Yeah, I think so. We're actually in St. Paul. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And we'll be getting back to your calls in a few minutes. But right now, Congressman Pete Sessions is with us. He's the U.S. Congressman from a Republican from the 32nd District of Texas. Sessions.house.gov, his website, if you want to check that out. His campaign website, Pete Sessions, SessionsIONS.com. And Congressman, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Great to have you here with us.
It's you know, being here is a little bit different than the 98 degrees in Dallas, Texas.
It's
a nice cool breeze this morning in Minnesota.
It is. It's beautiful. I'm curious. John McCain is notoriously a gambler. You know, he's the stories about him spending 11 hours straight at the craps tables and things. Not that he's I don't mean to imply that he's out of control or something, but he loves to gamble. Is this Palin choice, was this too much of a gamble? I mean, CBS News is now reporting that she's confirmed that her daughter is pregnant. There's concerns about her judgment in flying home from Texas, 14-hour flight when she's in labor, you know, things like that. There's a bunch of stuff just starting to pop up. Her first press conference, she says she was against the bridge from nowhere when she has a long history of actually outspokenly and publicly being in favor of it. So her first press conference, she's lying. Was this a gamble that's going to backfire? Is there any chance that the Republican Party is going to pull this nominee? Is that why all the Republican public efforts have been shut down for this day of the convention? Because tomorrow it's actually going to be Mitt Romney. I don't mean this as a gotcha question.
I don't take it that way at all. You and I both learned this morning this report by about her daughter.
Yeah.
I didn't vet her. Don't know who did. I think the vetting process is always very important. I think on the surface, the things that we learned about Sarah Palin were very favorable.
Yeah, I thought this is going to be a strong competitor, and we underestimate her at considerable risk.
Well, and she brings to the table a lot of things that a lot of people back home really are strengths about them, making our communities, our PTAs, our...
Yeah.
Communities work. I don't know enough about the things which you spoke about whether she was for or against the bridge to nowhere.
Yeah.
We're going to find out something.
Yeah. I suspect.
It happens. Look, let's just talk about this. When you have a person that is not as well known, you need to ask a lot of questions.
Yeah. Yeah. And I would assume that very early on, you know, the first questions would have been asked of her is, you know, are there any things that the National Enquirer is going to be checking into about you? And that she would have said, well, there's this thing about my daughter being pregnant.
I would assume you're correct. Let me say this. I would assume the questions were asked.
Yeah, yeah. They were not properly answered, then maybe this party is thinking this isn't the right choice.
I don't know what the party's thinking now, but I do know that the questions that you're rightfully asking need to be asked, and then somebody's going to have to talk about them. Because the last thing we really want is for the issues to be different than what we brought to the table.
I agree. Speaking to somebody on the other side, you know, I think that we need to have a clear, open, honest discussion about what are the economic policies going to be for this country? What are the foreign policies going to be for this country? How are we going to deal with the Soviet Union? How are we going to deal with Saakashvili? What are we going to do about, Iran and nuclear reactors?
Right.
All these should be the topics of discussion, not whether the vice presidential candidate has a daughter with an illegitimate child and whether that has anything to do with her open opposition to sex education in public schools.
Tell them what it brings up.
Yeah.
And let me be blunt about this. The Republican Party is faced with a circumstance now with a storm that we're respectfully trying to deal with that. I can't say what the right or wrong answer is except to respect the people who are in harm's way.
Yeah.
I think Senator McCain made the right call. But now that it's not a Category 4, it's a Category 2, we ought to move on. But we think we have the answers for each of the questions that is not only way different, but which would encourage our economy and job growth and continuing to where America's greatest
days. Let's talk about those things.
Good.
That's
what we came here for.
Indeed. It's all politics, I think, ultimately. But
it's policy.
Yeah.
This is policy.
Okay, let's get into policy stuff. Congressman Pete Sessions is with us from Texas, PeteSessions.com. And what are the areas where John McCain is significantly differentiated from Barack Obama in ways that, in your opinion, are going to help the average American worker?
The things which we know about the record of Senator Barack Obama and the things which we know about at least the Republican Party and John McCain would be several changes. First of all, I consider it a detriment. We consider it, your listeners, however they choose to. The United States Senate has Bernie Sanders, who is an avowed socialist.
Actually, democratic socialist.
He's a socialist. He is with the Democratic Party. He caucuses with them.
Right. He calls himself a democratic socialist, as in Scandinavia, as in Denmark, Sweden, Norway.
Well, if you look at the old House website, and I only served with Bernie for 10 years, it was listed socialist.
Yeah. No, that's a fact. I'm not disputing it. I'm just
Senator Barack Obama has a more liberal.
I know Bernie quite well, actually.
I do too. Yeah. A very liberal, a more liberal voting record than the avowed socialist.
Yeah.
The things which Senator Barack Obama are proudest of is his service when he served as a state senator for Illinois. It was literally about taxing employers, and he wants to bring that to play now with a trillion dollar tax on corporations.
Okay, so here's the question. We have a $10 trillion debt, or we're facing a $9 trillion debt.
It's a deficit.
No, that's the debt. The deficit is $800 billion. The debt is $9 trillion.
That is correct.
Respectfully.
There you go.
And when Ronald Reagan came into office, it was under $1 trillion.
Yes.
We've had, you know, basically borrow and spend economics from the Republican Party here.
We
for
have.
30,
now, let's be
years.
Honest about that. Half, over 55% of that is Social Security. And the reason why it's Social Security is because the tax cuts created 5.3 million new jobs.
None of that is Social Security, sir. The Social Security Trust Fund right now is in surplus.
That is not correct. They are IOUs, and over half of the $9.9 trillion is Social Security.
No, the debt is not Social Security. The debtor, or the creditor, is Social Security. Social Security has loaned its money to the United States
correct.
Government.
That's correct.
And by virtue of buying Treasury notes, just as if Saudi Arabia had bought those Treasury notes, or you have, I had bought those Treasury
and
notes,
that doesn't mean Social Security
is in debt. It means that the federal government is in debt.
Half of the 10 is directly related to IOUs to Social Security.
But Social Security Trust Fund is loaning money to the federal government.
That's correct.
So what the Republicans have been doing is they have been borrowing money from the Social Security Trust Fund, spending that money and saying, gee, look, we're having a great time here. I mean, you give me a $10 trillion credit card, I'll show you what it looks like to live large. But is that the right thing for our children and grandchildren?
Not exactly the way you make it seem.
How is it then?
Well, the way it is that what Social Security does is it takes out from the time a person comes and gets in Social Security, they extrapolate out over 50 years an unpaid liability.
Right.
And is an unpaid liability.
Well, that's what David Walker
is talking
about, but that's not the debt.
It's Republicans that are trying to have a plan where we do something. It's our friends that are Democrats that said it's not even a problem.
Well, if you eliminated the cap, it wouldn't be a problem. Why should Bill Gates pay less than 1/100th of 1% of his income in Social Security taxes, and I have to pay, and you have to pay, you know, 10-12% of our income in Social Security taxes? Why should that be?
We're operating off the way it is. Why don't we just tax everybody a whole lot more money, which is what Barack Obama wants to do?
Well, I'm just arguing for a flat tax.
Well, I'm for a flat tax.
Okay, let's make Social Security a flat tax. Let's have Bill Gates pay the exact same percentage in Social Security as you and I pay.
You know,
the Republicans are opposed to this.
And I'll tell you why. We're opposed to raising taxes on Social Security because it's a cost where people quit employing people.
This is only raising taxes on Social Security on people earning over $102,000.
Well, that has to do with a lot of people
who are paying nothing on Social Security right now.
Nothing?
After the $102,000, no, they pay nothing.
That is the system. And so if you want to kill jobs in this country, just go ahead and raise Social Security, and people will quit employing people.
So you think that if millionaires and billionaires, people who have incomes in the millions and billions a year, have to pay Social Security on that income, that that's going to cause working people who are making $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 a year to lose their jobs?
What I'm talking about is that corporations will end up paying that amount of money. And where you have corporations that then increase their expenses, they employ fewer people. Yes, I do stand by that.
Okay. Congressman Pete Sessions, people can read all about it at PeteSessions.com.
Absolutely.
Or House.Sessions.gov. Is that it? Or Sessions.House.gov.
Probably, yeah.
Congressman, thank you very much.
Sure,
I enjoy a spirited discussion.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
You hold your own very well. 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. a paradise I find that sets me loose. Mine the truth.
21 minutes past the hour. Here's a great line. It's from Don, the Green Dog Democrat in our chat room. He says, Tom, here's a meme. 2 years ago, Joe Biden was staring across the table at Slobodan Milosevic saying, "You, sir, are a war criminal." 2 years, Sarah Palin was sitting across the table saying, "We have to find a way to keep the town dump open later." Yeah. Amazing. So all this stuff is coming out about Sarah Palin. And frankly, you know, her daughter being pregnant and whether or not, you know, whether she's a mother or a grandmother and all that kind of stuff. I suspect that that's going to end up, it may be the stuff that freaks out the Republicans, frankly. It may be the stuff that even causes them to pull her off the ticket. I mean, you heard Congressman Pete Sessions, one of the most outspoken and articulate Republican members of the House of Representatives, just, you know, basically dealing with those issues and going, whoa, wait a minute. But, you know, on behalf of his party, I guess, right, speaking for himself anyway. But I think that it's these, well, for example, her coming out and saying that the Pledge of Allegiance, if it was good enough for the Founding Fathers, it was good enough for me. I'm sorry, the Pledge of Allegiance was rolled out in 1942 as a way of pushing back, by and large, against, by Franklin Roosevelt, Republicans who didn't think that we should be fighting a war against Hitler. Republicans who didn't think we should be fighting a war against Hitler. Rex Stout, the famous author, 72 million books in print, the Nero Wolf books, wrote this book called The Illustrious Dunderheads, and all it is a collection of speeches by Republicans on the floor of the House of Representatives and the U.S. Senate in the late 30s and early 40s, talking about how Hitler was a nice guy and we had no business getting involved in a foreign war in Europe. By the way, this story being reported over at the Boston Globe. A prominent human rights group says Georgia, the country of Georgia, Saakashvili, the guy who imprisoned protesters, the guy who rigged an election, the guy who shut down a television station because he didn't like what they were broadcasting about him, the guy who dropped bombs on South Ossetia, that's how I'm hearing Russians pronounce it, Ossetia, dropped bombs at midnight, provoking Putin the next day to say, okay, we're going to kick you out of this country, Charlie, has admitted dropping cluster bombs in its military offensive to assert control over the rest of the province of South Ossetia. M85 cluster munition. Cluster bombs are what are used to kill civilians, to kill large numbers of people. But when Georgia was dropping these bombs, they were dropping them on Svengali, the capital city, which was not a military enclave. It was a city. Here we're finding that one of our allies, a very problematic ally, frankly, may well be guilty of terrible, terrible war crimes. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Jill in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Jill, what's up?
Hey, Tom, it's good to talk to you. Thanks for taking my call. I was listening to the congressman from Texas, and I sometimes think they must be in a parallel universe.
Interesting because, you know, to his credit, when he would say a talking point and I would point out to him that it wasn't true, he acknowledged that. So,
yeah.
I have to say we should give Pete Sessions some kudos for that.
Well, I'm still not sure how he's thinking about Social Security, but...
Yeah.
I wanted to talk about the fact that they're shorting their Republican convention because of the hurricane. Laura Bush is going to be this afternoon talking about Hurricane Rita. I wonder if this time, instead of Hurricane Karina, she'll get it Hurricane Dust. And it strikes me that these Republicans are always trying to tell us how we can contribute to the relief of hurricane victims. I was in New Orleans last October gutting houses and helping a group of Corvallis, Oregon women establish a nonprofit furniture bank. Individual people are working on a continuing hurricane relief, and this administration has demonstrated a total lack of compassion as I see it, their concern now is in protecting new construction in New Orleans that has occurred with corporations who have appropriated abandoned property. They haven't rebuilt the Ninth Ward for the people of the Ninth Ward. They've rebuilt it for the corporations that have the money to
No, absolutely.
Take it over.
This has been just like Iraq. It's been no-bid processes. It's been crony capitalism. It's been out-of-state contractors. It has been Republican donors and Republican affiliated corporations. Absolutely, Jill, and thank you for pointing that out. Tom in Goodyear, Arizona, we have a half a minute before the break. Tom, what's up?
Thanks, Tom. Just real quick, I lived up in Ketchikan. In fact, I used to listen to you there on satellite when I first got there. Just a quick question for you. This bridge to nowhere, clearly, I attended the function where prospective Governor Palin was, you know, all behind the bridge, the funding, Don Young getting the earmark, building the infrastructure. My question is this. Is this a candidate's naivete and a campaign's quick vetting process, or is it the McCain campaign's hubris to say that the truth is what we say it is?
I think it's both. I think it's absolutely both, Tom, and you said it in a perfect way. I mean, it's hubris.
Hey, you know, we can do anything.
It's John McCain, the gambler, the guy who spends 11 hours straight at the craps table, the high stakes craps table. Craps table, excuse me. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is Tom Hartman. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
You see, there was this riverboat gambler. He was actually a card player, a poker player for a living. He was a professional poker player, and he decided to take a vacation on a cruise ship. But you know, being a gambler, he just couldn't pass up when he heard that there was a game going on. You know, just a kind of off the books game going on down in the boiler room. And so he goes down and he's sitting there with some of the crew and a couple of other guys playing, and they deal the cards out, and he's looking as the cards are dealt to him, and there's the king of clubs and queen of clubs and jack of clubs and the ace of clubs and the ten of clubs. He's looking at this royal flush and he's going, "Whoa! Never in my life have I been dealt a royal flush. It must be the ship. It must be that I'm so lucky because I am here on the USS Titanic." And I'm wondering if that's John McCain's, you know, he's John McCain, a notorious gambler, a famous gambler, has gambled on Sarah Palin. And the gamble, perhaps, of his career, the gamble of the party. Shannon Moore is with us. I want to get a lot of Alaska voices on here, as many as possible. Shannon Moore is a talk show host in Anchorage, Alaska. She's heard on KWHL Radio, regular panelist on Fagan Report. On the Fagan Report, on weekly televised political forum on KIMO, that's Channel 13 in Anchorage, and a regular sub on KFQD Radio in Anchorage. Her website, Shannon, Shanyn, Moore, Moore, .wordpress.com. Shannon, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Tom.
We just heard this morning that CBS has confirmed that Sarah Palin's daughter is pregnant. What's the significance of this?
Well, a grandchild and being a 44-year-old grandmother, I suppose. It did just come out people knew this, but she just put out an official release saying that she was very proud that her daughter has decided to keep this child and that she's getting married. So I think that it doesn't roll well with a lot of people across the country. I mean, you can be the poster child for pro-life or anti-choice, and you can display that in as many ways as you possibly can. But at the end of the day, I think most Americans, their family values may or may not include choice, but they certainly aren't wishing for 17-year-old pregnant girls.
Shannon, was this an open secret in Alaska?
Well, I know that it has been rumbling around for some time, and a lot of us were like, well, there's no way that could possibly be true, because we're quite sure that she was completely vetted, and there could be nothing like this come up and surprise the McCain administration. They would have never, they would have never selected her had they known this was on the ticket.
Mm. And so apparently she lied to the McCains, or maybe her daughter was lying to her. I mean, who knows? It's I'm curious about your take on the story, the post that's over at Daily Kos, that they've been keeping off the front page. I mean, the folks at Daily Kos are, I think, probably pretty, I can't speak for them, obviously, but I think they're pretty ambivalent about it. They're keeping the threat alive, which I congratulate them for, and at the same time, they're also not featuring it on the front page, which I think is also a wise decision. That suggests that, in fact, the Down syndrome child, Trey, the three-month-old that Sarah is the mother of, she's actually the grandmother of, and that this might, if her daughter's pregnant, this might be her second pregnancy. Is that any credibility to that, or is this crazy? And again, is it any of our damn business?
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess the fundamental question is it any of our damn business? And I really, you know, most of the time I would say no, but the fact that I think it really shows a lot about Sarah Palin. You don't have very much to go on with her, certainly on a national scene. We do here locally. I know I had a talk show host right at the same time. I got a job as a talk show host the same time she got her governorship. So I covered her every day, and I'm a progressive. And so, you know, when it came to development issues, when it came to budget issues, when it came to providing health care through the Denali Kid Care Program, you know, she didn't do anything to help that would actually be covering her daughter now. So I was really critical of a lot of things, and at the same time, she did quite a few things that I agreed with, and I agreed with those publicly and have a relationship with her because of that. But when I look at this, the story of, you know, was it her daughter's child, this Down syndrome baby, and that whole thing, you know, that's really salacious and sexy, and Daily Kos has really put it out there, and a lot of bloggers have. But I actually, on my website, I had put up a post that the official story was more disturbing to me than the Daily Kos story.
Well, that's what I started with. A woman who is in pre-labor, who's having contractions and who's leaking amniotic fluid, decides, instead of going to the hospital in Dallas, Texas, decides to take 14 hours of travel and 11 hours in the air on two flights connecting through Seattle, and then even bypass a major hospital with a neonatal unit and go to a little, you know, podunk outfit in the town of 7,000 where she used to be the mayor to give birth. What kind of judgment is that, if that's what you're talking about?
Well, if she was doing all this as a cover-up to keep it from being public that her daughter had become pregnant, I get that. She didn't want her daughter to be in the public light.
Sure.
She didn't want her family values to be questioned. And at a certain
level, you know, we can, as a parent at least, I can honor that.
That's what I'm saying. I could actually understand that, and I said that at the time on the air. I was like, well, that part I could understand when a caller came in with this, but when I'm looking at the official story, I mean, I can tell you right now that when I went into labor, my first question was not peanuts or pretzels. It was, is this baby going to be safe? And I wasn't a high-risk mom, and I knew that the child I had on board was healthy. Now, her official story was at 4 a.m. She started leaking amniotic fluid. You know, she decided to stay in Dallas. She'd already been flying a lot that week. And then she, you know, waited, gave a speech at noon at a luncheon, left, got on a plane, didn't get to Alaska till close to midnight. I mean, that's really dangerous. And so for being pro-life, I think she took some pretty serious risks with her own health, with the health of that baby. But also it showed a real disregard for people on that flight who could have been going to, unplug someone off life support or go have, you know, a job interview that was going to change their life or be at a wedding. And they could have had to emergency land that plane. So I called Alaska Airlines when this first hit, and I know I was the only person in Alaska that was talking out loud about this. And I said, "So when did you start letting women in labor on your plane?" They just went through the roof. They just said, This is outrageous. We would never allow someone, if we knew, if we had to land, do an emergency landing, and we knew that they knew that they were in labor, we would charge them with the refueling cost and that sort of charges. So, and
I understand that there was actually one, or actually I don't understand this, but the gossip, let's just call it that,
yes,
is that there's
is.
At least one flight attendant, and you can tell me whether or not this is actually true, there's at least one flight attendant with Alaskan Airlines who is on the record saying that, you know, everybody recognizes Sarah Palin, I mean, on Alaska Airlines, she's the governor, right, and that she didn't look, A, distressed, and she didn't look, B, pregnant.
Yeah, I know that there is a flight attendant on the record for saying that. I've also talked to people who were working in Juneau who said, wow, she didn't look pregnant. You know, and you know, some people do, some people don't. But to me, all of that is speculation. And the truth be told, the speculation story I'm more comfortable with than the truth, or the, you know, the
in
official
other words,
story.
If she was lying to cover up and protect her daughter, that's something that as parents, you and I can both say, you know, if we had to live in the Republican world where this thing is shameful, I guess, then we can empathize with that. But on the other hand, if what she did was put at risk a child that was at the verge of birth by not going to a hospital in Dallas and saying, hey, I'm leaking amniotic fluid here and I'm having contractions, and she put all the people on the plane at risk, and frankly put her own life at risk. I mean, childbirth is not without risk to the mother as well.
Especially when you're 44.
Yeah. Then we have to ask the question, what kind of judgment does this woman have?
Well, and I know a lot of women that were upset with, you know, we're trying to get the Family Leave Act pushed through, and here she goes back to work on Monday after having a baby on Friday. And what, I'm not a supergirl because I wasn't even out of the hospital yet, you know. And so there was a lot, I mean, of course that worked for her, whatever, but it to me, her official story is more disturbing and says more about her judgment than if the conspiracy that Daily Kos and all these bloggers are putting out there is the actual, you know, story.
Yeah. It's a tough one. It's either way, you know, she loses, and this is why I'm thinking that the reason why the Republicans are not allowing any Republicans to stand up today and say yes, McCain-Palin, and instead they're just doing the pro forma legal requirements for the first day of the convention has nothing to do with this hurricane. It has everything to do with the fact that this might be a Tom Eagleton choice. Tom Eagleton, of course, the Democrat who did not reveal to, what was it, George McGovern, as I recall, that he had had electroshock therapy for depression, and they pulled him off the ticket at the last minute because he didn't reveal it. And I just wonder if she's going to stay on this ticket. So, Shannon Moore, shannynmoore.wordpress.com. Shannon, thanks a lot for dropping by.
My pleasure. Thanks, Tom.
Good talking with you. It's 45 minutes past the hour, 866-303-2270. Back with your questions.
The Tom Hartman Program. Visit us on the web at hartmanradio.com.
There's nothing like staring into a starry sky, you know. It just, for me anyway, that's when I know that I'm alive and that the universe is alive, that it's all alive, that it's all sacred. We'll be talking about that, actually, more broadly speaking, you know, pro-life Democrats, things like that, with Jenna Robert, who will be with us at the top of the hour. Right now, we'll take your calls, 866-303-2270, our telephone number. David in Flower Mound, Texas. Hey, David, what's on your mind?
All right.
Hey, you're on the air, David.
Good morning, Tom. First, I'd like to say thanks for being here every day and doing what you're doing and keeping these Americans sharp and thinking critically. As a registered voter and a parent, and not only just a parent, but a parent of a special needs child, I am somewhat confused and very concerned about this Governor Palin situation. If there is indeed question about the child, the special needs child, being Governor Palin's as opposed to her daughter's, then I would immediately feel compelled to start looking at fraud issues concerning her employment and the insurance that is available for this child. As the grandchild, there's going to be no insurance coverage as the child and a government official. The child is going to have the best available coverage and care it can be had. And as a parent of a special needs child, when this is not available to the general population, even though we pay our premiums and do everything that they ask for, there are so many things that are not covered. And instead of being asked for the public support and the vote to make this woman vice president, I would think that we would be looking at fraud charges being brought against her rather than her being on the ticket.
Yeah.
And as a truck driver, I'm in and out of my truck, so I don't get to hear everything that's going on in the program and all the conversations, so I get bits and pieces of it. I could be confused and off base on this issue, but I think that I've heard enough to understand what the real question is here. As a parent of five, and actually someone that has flown from Dallas to Alaska, I can't see the option available to her to actually make the flight and continue through. Because after the second or third child and the water breaks, we're
it's a fast
talking
thing.
A very, very short time before the child is born.
Yeah.
And so I'm really confused and concerned about this whole thing. And I don't know who broke the story, but hats off to him. Congratulations. And I'm looking for a lot of follow-up on this.
Yeah. David, thank you very much. It's the folks over at the Daily Kos, and although they didn't break the story. There was a couple of blogs in Alaska that have been talking about this for months. I mean, this is not a brand new story. It's just it's well condensed over Daily Kos. Michael Moore has a link to it from michaelmoore.com. If I get a chance here at the top of the hour, I'll put a link to it from tomhartman.com. James in Indianapolis. Hey, James.
How are you?
Good. What's up?
Going back towards the whole the New Orleans situation. Could you possibly get James Witt on your show sometime?
Yeah, that would be a. We'll see. We'll see. That's a good suggestion.
Just that move to take FEMA and put it under Homeland Security.
I know.
That says all you need to know about these guys.
Yeah.
And that.
And they're dancing their hearts out right now because it's happening at the same time the RNC is happening.
I was part of a task force that went down from Indiana down to Mississippi, and that's where the epicenter was. My concern is, are the levees really safe enough to withstand anything? I mean, that was not a direct hit with Katrina.
And it was Cat 2 when it hit land.
Yeah. And who knows what, if it's the Army Corps or if it's KBR, for Pete's sake, that's been doing the work on the levees.
Yeah. So, James, that was the point you wanted to make. I got to move along here. I got a bunch
I'll let you go.
Okay, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Well said. Meryl in Miami, Florida. Hey, Meryl.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Just great.
This is all very interesting. I mean, if, in fact, her daughter did give birth to the child, and they're saying that her daughter is pregnant now, then that's another lie. And
maybe.
And that's...
Maybe your daughter just got pregnant twice, or maybe her official story is actually true, in which case her judgment is really weird.
Well, it's possible she got pregnant twice, but don't forget, they're saying in the newspapers that she's due in December, which is 1 month after the election. So there's nothing to say that she won't, after the election, all of a sudden lose the baby. You know, I'm saying this, you know, in quotes, that the story will be that she lost the baby. And,
so you think,
you know,
you're suggesting that the official announcement today that her daughter is pregnant is using is a cover-up of the cover-up that her daughter is actually the mother of her youngest child. And, you know, that's really craven, because that's really using, that's exploiting your kid. In, I mean, that she would really be exploiting her daughter in that way.
Well, she's been doing some pretty funky stuff.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I mean, she's Meryl, been lying.
She has been. She absolutely has been. Meryl, I just have a minute left. I want to get Jennifer from New Jersey in here. Thank you for the call. Jennifer in New Jersey, you're on.
Yes,
on
Tom, here. I just want to tell you how much I really love you, and I'm so sorry you aren't on the radio here, and I wish you'd come back, but I'm so pleased to speak to you. I agree with Meryl 100%, but let me just put a caveat on that. We have watched the Rovian tactics do the similar thing, that they will try, you know, when you get close to the truth, that they will try and spin it to distract. And the issue here, whatever the truth is, we must get to the truth. And in order to get to the truth, we need to keep all options open in order to investigate it, because it's the cover-up. It's not the deed. I mean, God bless the daughter if she did have the baby, you know, if she was pregnant before. That's not, that doesn't bother me. God bless the child.
No, in fact, you know, we honor that. I mean, it's that.
No, exactly.
But
it's cover-up, and I don't want any more people, excuse me, messing with this country with lies.
Well said. Jennifer, thank you very much for the call. Much appreciated. It's 57 minutes past the hour at the top of the hour. Janet Roberts is going to drop by and talk with us about, get into this conversation about life, pro-choice. What does all this mean? What's going on? And what does it have to do with the Democratic Party?
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. This is interesting. Blackwater International is running a full-page ad on their website attempting to compile, this is a quote from the ad, a list of qualified security personnel for possible deployment into areas affected by Hurricane Gustav. They're preparing to privatize another disaster, put paramilitary what do you call them? Goons? No, mercenaries. Mercenaries in the United States, now that we no longer have Posse Comitatus. Well, that's, Posse Comitatus is U.S. military. Anyhow, I will be so happy when this administration is out of office and we can get back to America as America. Janet Robert is with me. Janet is both the president of AM 950 KTNF, the voice of Minnesota, the radio station that we're on. And she's also the chairperson, or the executive director, rather, of Democrats for Life of Minnesota. DemocratsForLife.org is the website, and .org/MN for Minnesota. Hey, Janet, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Tom.
Glad to have you with us. And the Democrats for Life, I find a fascinating phenomenon. I think that most Americans have bought the caricature, and frankly, it is a caricature, that all Republicans are absolutely gung-ho in, or all Democrats, rather, are absolutely gung-ho, I don't want to say in favor of abortion, but in favor of abortion rights. Let's put it that way. In favor of the right of a woman to have an abortion if she chooses to. And all the shades of gray around that stuff get lost in the discussion. But perhaps more importantly, the fact that there's a significant percentage of Democrats who identify themselves as pro-life is lost in that discussion.
That's absolutely true. The surveys have shown that probably over 47% of Democrats in the United States characterize themselves as pro-life, but they're very afraid to tell that to people because they feel like they'll be ostracized from the party, which they frequently are.
Yeah. And in fact, you've experienced this yourself, right?
Absolutely. When I ran for political office the first time, I never told anyone I was pro-life. I was very active in the party, raised a lot of money for our Democratic candidates. And then when I did run and had to make my position clear, I was told, just get out of the party. You don't belong here.
Holy cow. Now, there has to be, I think, some sort of a meeting ground within the party between, frankly, I don't know of anybody who is you know, just, you know, anybody should be able to have an abortion anytime they want for any reason, just for fun. Abortion should be a technique of birth control. I mean, it's perhaps there are a few people out there who believe that, but that's the lunatic fringe, in my opinion.
About 10% of Americans do identify with that position. In a Gallup poll show that.
Who would be willing to abort a baby a week before birth?
Yes.
No.
That's what the whole debate about partial birth abortion was. Remember, Clinton vetoed the partial birth abortion ban. So.
But that was because it didn't provide for the health of the woman, was it not? And that's my recollection of it.
Well, yes, that's always the reasons it's used. And now that exception to most pro-lifers has come to mean basically abortion on demand. To the American public, it means abortion on demand. So the health of the mother exception is so broad.
Yeah.
But what we try to do, there truly is common ground, because if you look at the American public, they want common ground.
Yeah.
But the Democratic Party, unfortunately, is so heavily funded by Planned Parenthood and AIRO-related groups that it's hard for people to find common ground. But we're doing it, and it's kind of exciting. We love the Democratic Party. We belong in the Democratic Party because we truly are the party that believes in supporting the pregnant woman, and we find most abortion decisions are made because a woman does not have the economic support that she needs. And we believe the Democratic Party will provide that support. They're committed to that. And so if we can provide four things to women, freedom from sexual and domestic violence, and we as the Democratic Party believe in that, we can provide them with a livable wage. And my own pro-life Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann voted against the minimum wage.
Whoa.
She's Republican.
Oh, I see.
And then if we can provide the woman with health care for the pregnant woman and child, and that would be the S-CHIP funding in universal health care. But again, Michelle Bachmann was opposed to that, as well as, you know, as our pro-life, quote, pro-life Republican. And finally, women want child care and help for it, and men want it too.
Right. I find it ironic, the number of Republicans who identify themselves as pro-life, and yet they're gung-ho for the death penalty. Does this seem like a non sequitur to you?
Absolutely. But my concern is the Democratic Party also has the same problem. We should be the party of the consistent life ethic, which recognizes the vulnerability of children and women and pregnant women all the way through the death penalty opposing it. And we as Democrats for Life try to support that consistent life ethic.
My mentor, I guess for lack of a better word, I actually wrote an entire book about this man. It's called The Prophet's Way. He's now 93 years old, lives in Germany. His name is Gottfried Müller. And after World War II, he started communities for abused kids around Germany. Actually, originally it was war orphans. And I, on behalf of he and his program, I set up a hospital in Uganda, which is still operating. It's now a community that is uniting widows, AIDS widows with AIDS orphans, and creating communities of them for them. We started programs in Togo. We started programs in Asia. We started programs in South America. And I write about all this in that book. He personally, although the organization did not take a position on abortion, he personally is very, very strongly opposed to abortion. So what he did was he bought some houses in a couple of different parts of Germany and printed up posters that said, if you're pregnant and you're thinking about having an abortion, come to where we are. We will take care of you. We'll give you a stipend. We'll take all your medical needs will be taken care of. We will make sure that your child is adopted appropriately. You can have as much or as little involvement with that as you want. And it will be, you know, painless, effortless. It won't cost you anything. We'll do everything we can then to help you reintegrate back into your original job and your family. And he had, I mean, over the 20, 30 years that they were doing this, that they've been doing this, they've prevented or gotten around, you know, thousands of abortions. It seems to me like common sense stuff, like preventing unwanted pregnancies, and I think Sarah Palin's daughter here is perhaps going to be the poster child for this, tragically. Preventing unwanted pregnancies on the one end, and on the other end, providing for women who are pregnant for whom abortion, you know, may be an option, but it's not their favorite option. It's just that their economic circumstances or life circumstances provide no other option. That really we should be putting a lot of effort there. And then perhaps the need to discuss whether this should be criminalized would diminish.
Yes, absolutely. And I think the Democrats are the best party that's able to provide those economic options for women. But I will tell you that one stereotype of pro-life Democrats is that we're all opposed to contraception, which is false. I mean, contraceptives. Right. So contraceptives is your first line of defense, but your second line of defense is the support. And I will tell you, us, the pro-life Democrats in my hometown of Stillwater built 3 shelters for pregnant women. And we also were the first ones on the street protesting going into Iraq. So the stereotypes have to fall away. Basically, what we believe in is that abortion is an act of violence. And you don't solve violence with violence. And we need to bring the society to a whole new level where we get away from the cycle of violence.
Yeah. This is where I met Pope John Paul II a few years back, well, almost 10 years ago, I think now. And I was very impressed by the man and started really following him and what he was saying. And he spoke forcefully, obviously against abortion, being Catholic, but he spoke forcefully against the death penalty in the United States. He personally asked George Bush not to execute a retarded child. He personally tried to intervene with Bush and to stop the war in Iraq. These are consistent positions of honoring human life. And, you know, where's the Democratic Party across the board on this? I mean, you know, we, by and large, we honor life. But
well, I think the Democratic Party, in almost all circumstances, honors life. That's the tragic thing. This one circumstance, they don't. But 47% of Democrats identify as pro-life, which means some reason the Democratic Party is not really speaking to its base.
Yeah. I really think the Democratic Party should be focusing far more on economic populist issues, and because ultimately, actually, those are the pro-life issues. You know, whether a woman can take a child to term has to do with whether she's got the money.
And you know, Tom, I'm pro-life, and I put talk show hosts on, and every last one of them almost is pro-choice. But you know what? You speak to the economic issues. I would love if you're all pro-life, too. But first and foremost, we got to help a woman economically, and then we can end the constant choice of abortion, which is a tragic act of violence.
And ultimately, I mean, Louise and I, we have 3 children. Louise also had a miscarriage. I mean, I know how difficult just a miscarriage is, wrenching. I can't imagine the decision to have an abortion. It must be a very difficult thing for most women. And so let's try to make them rare.
Yes.
And you know, in my world, safe and legal, but in your world, rare. And there is some real common ground. And protect women who don't want to have abortions. Absolutely, let's do it. Janet Robert. Thanks so much, Janet.
Thank you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman here with you, defying the conservative weapons of mass deception. Sylvia Allegretto is with us. She is a labor economist with the Institute for Research on Labor and Employment. Oh, by the way, let me mention Janet Roberts' website, our last guest, is democratsforlife.org, lest we forget. Sylvia is with us. She's an economist with the Institute for Research on Labor and Employment, the University of California, Berkeley. And Sylvia, welcome to the show.
Hi, Tom. How are you today?
I am great. I should call you Dr. Allegretto, right?
If you'd like, but it's not necessary.
Okay. Today is Labor Day, and we have some truly startling labor statistics here. The Associated Press reporting more than 10% of Americans are underemployed, discouraged, or seeking work, a 25% increase from a year ago. 530,000 Americans were subject to mass layoffs just in the last year, and on it goes. Why is it that the American press doesn't talk about labor and working people's issues? There's a business section in every newspaper. There's a business, even on NPR, They have business. They have a half-hour business show. I've never heard a labor show.
Yeah, I think that what happens in the media a lot of the times is that there's a disconnect between Main Street and Wall Street, if you will. There's a lot of talk about the markets. There's a lot of talk about stocks and corporations and businesses. But you're right. We fall way short when it comes to talking about workers. And I'm honored to be on your show today, given that it is Labor Day, and that workers face serious economic challenges this Labor Day. With the fallout from this sluggish economy that has turned south for workers, as unemployment is on the increase, we're up to 5.7% when we bottomed out at about 4.4% back in 2006 or so. The bottom has fallen out of the labor market as we've shed over 650,000 jobs just this year alone. So, and I think the reports that came out from the Census Bureau this week shows that the average worker is doing no better today than they were back before this recovery. Remember, this recovery started way back in the end of 2001. We're 6.5 years into this economic expansion that has done little for average workers.
So we're talking with Sylvia Allegretto, the labor economist at the University of California in Berkeley. What do we do? I mean, I'm out here talking about this all the time. I'm very proud that our show is sponsored by both SEIU and the Teamsters, Teamsters.org, SEIU.org. Mm-hmm. And I'm speaking at an SEIU gig this afternoon, a labor gig here in Minneapolis. We have a labor segment on the show every single week. We're out there trying to do this. But, you know, I remember growing up that in Michigan, the Detroit Free Press, the Detroit News, the two statewide papers, one was the Democratic paper and had a labor section. The other was the Republican paper. It had a business section. Now there's no labor sections anymore.
Yeah.
It's as if big business has taken over America. And it's as if basically since Reagan, the average American doesn't even realize what Abraham Lincoln said. That labor precedes capital. Nothing, you know, there is no wealth until somebody makes something.
That's right. And I think it's good to keep in mind that we have some of the best workforce. We have some of the most productive workforce. I mean, productivity has soared over this economic expansion that is, again, over 6.5 years old. We like to think that increases in productivity are what increases real standards of living. But those gains have not been passed to the worker. And it is that we have to bring back that connection between productivity.
Historically, they have. I mean, from the founding of this country until Reagan became president, productivity and wages pretty much tracked each other. And that was a good thing because productivity determines the supply of stuff in the marketplace. And if the demand for stuff in the marketplace doesn't equal the supply of stuff in the marketplace, you got a problem. And that demand was driven by wages. And
right.
when Reagan started destroying the American workforce and reducing our wages, people started, you know, the demand had to remain the same. So Greenspan says, oh, well, let's just make credit easy. And all of a sudden, my dog is getting a credit card application. And people are turning their houses into ATM machines. And we're using credit rather than wages to meet the demand that is that consumes the products of our own productivity. This is a death spiral, isn't it?
Well, it is, and that's why we have to make sure that when we're having times of prosperity, when the economy is expanding like it has been since the 2001 recession, we want to make sure that we have broad-based prosperity, that everybody is active in getting their share of the economic pie, and when the pie increases, that the shares of each increase, so that workers get a bigger share of the pie as their productivity increases. And we did have that. If we go back to the last economic expansion, the one that followed the early 1990s recession, when we had tight labor markets and full employment, that was great because everybody was benefiting from the
right,
bottom.
Right, we had
to
a Democrat
top.
In the White House then. You
That's right.
Sylvia, we're out of time, but I thank you so much. Sylvia Allegretto, Dr. Sylvia Allegretto from the University of California, Berkeley. Great work you're doing. Thank you.
Thank you.
27 minutes past.
This is Tom Hartman. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
where nothing matters. Come on, let's make this dream. It's barely half awake. Come true.
Four minutes past the hour, Tom Hartman here with you, and my favorite right-wing curmudgeon is sitting here with me, Greg Clapper, Republican libertarian consultant, a consultant to all kinds of campaigns. You did a campaign some years ago in Oregon, and the committee that you created for it was the Let's Shine
a Little Light on Him and See If He Scampers
Committee. Yes.
Yeah, it was a governor's race, and well, the guy didn't win.
Yeah,
see? Imagine.
I would not want to be on the receiving end of your spot.
You know, ordinarily I wouldn't do interviews like this when it's raining somewhere in the country.
You know? Yes. I mean. Well, this, which raises a question. Are you hearing the buzz that I'm hearing, that the reason that the Republicans shut this thing down is because they got blindsided by the whole Palin thing with their daughter?
No, I don't think they were blindsided. They knew it.
But?
I think the Katrina thing just weighed heavily. I don't
then
think
why
it
did
had...
they turn the first day of the convention into a fundraiser?
Well, they're kind of doing that. You know, that's what they... I saw some stuff last night that was distributed all day yesterday, and that's exactly what they're trying to do. Yeah. But you know how this world... I mean, look, being a media consultant, I'm telling you that these guys overreact when you have a whole room full of media consultants all coming up with an idea, you know, the committee mentality. Well, we got to do this. Well, if we do that, how about we do this? You know, that type of thing.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's just preposterous.
So, Greg, here we have the Republicans apparently running on the fact. I mean, Pete Sessions was sitting here trying to tell me that this was some kind of good thing, I think, if I understood him right, running on a $9 trillion debt, you know, brought to us courtesy of Reagan, Bush, and Clinton actually reversed it, Reagan, Bush, and Bush. And running on the idea that Bill Gates should pay 1/1,000th of a percent of the Social Security tax that you and I pay. And running on the fact that they want to continue borrowing money from my children and your children and our grandchildren, if I should ever have any, knock on wood. They're running on that as if it's some kind of a virtue. I don't get it. Tell me how this is a virtue, this borrow and spend craziness of the Republican
Party. Borrowing
is
terrible, but remember, always put into context your $9 trillion figure. What percentage of that is relative to the national...
National economy, you mean GDP?
GDP, exactly.
Yeah, well, I don't think that the average American really cares what it is relative to GDP when they realize that every baby born today is born with a $34,000 debt to the federal government.
Right, but it is
because Reagan wanted to spend money and make the country look
initially
good.
I went through that very same phase, you know, back in the Reagan years, and until I finally spent some time reading economics and stuff. And I'm telling you, the most important figure is the percentage of GDP. That's not to say that you shouldn't be borrowing.
I'll give it to you that that's important. In fact, I'll give you a talking point. Roosevelt in 44, mm-hmm. spent 110% of GDP. Mm-hmm. I mean, the federal budget was 110% of GDP to fight the war, fight
wars
World War II.
Are like that,
but the fact of the matter is that within the next 10, 15 years, we were back down to, you know, 1-3% of GDP. I mean, it got paid off. There not only is no discussion of paying it off, all the discussion that Republicans are putting forward is, let's take it to $20 billion.
All I can say,
or trillion.
All I can say is that's the best argument for term limits I have ever seen.
That term limits has got nothing to do. We have term
it
limits every two years. It's called an election.
No, please. You have the incumbent advantage. You can get back. For example, I was in Juneau on Friday. I love Alaska. All right. You pull into there. I'm up there to see my two daughters, which, incidentally, this is on in Juneau, Alaska.
Yes.
And so I pull up there to see my two daughters. And I go into the restaurant right next to the airport. I'm sitting here just like this, you know, 4-year-old grandson. I'm up there for his birthday. Ted Stevens walks in, sits down, says, hey, how you doing?
Oh, interesting.
There's
only 600,000 people in the whole state.
Right.
I lived in Vermont for 11 years and got to know Bernie Sanders.
Right.
I
mean, but my point is, Ted Stevens never did any of that until he was there for a long, long time.
Yeah.
And if you go back and you look at the corruption, always ask the question, when in their political career did they do this? It's a feeling of entitlement. The mentality, I work with these people, and I'm telling you, it's a horrible system in that these people spend their entire days getting their butt kissed.
But if you
how they live.
If you have term limits, then the only people who are serving, then you've got two problems. Number one, are the only people who are serving are basically the gentleman farmers, the ones who can afford to take a couple of years out of their life, knowing that they're not, that there's no future for them, that they're going to have to, you know, punt when they get back into the private economy, which is a pretty scary place right now, thanks to you guys for the last 30 years. And secondly, you're going to get people who are in there because, and this is what we're seeing right now in big ways in the regulatory agencies. You know, like during the first Bush administration, the guy who did the first GMO regulations, he came out of industry, quit his job at one of the big chemical companies, was hired by Bush to write the regulations that regulated that chemical company, worked for 2 years as a bureaucrat doing that, and then went back to that chemical company where he is still, where he's working to this day, or at least was working when I wrote the book about it 8 years ago. You would see more Billy Towsons, people going in just so that they can do the bidding of pharma, put that piece of legislation in there, knowing that when they get out with the term limits, they got a $2 million a year job waiting for them. I'm real pleased that somebody would consider a life of public service, that they would do like Ted Kennedy did, that they would do like Jack Kennedy did, that they would do, or the middle, you know, the Mr. Smith goes to Washington, that they would commit their lives to public service, knowing that if they put in their 20 years and they're honest and they do right, that there's going to be at least a pension at the end.
I can't stand Jimmy Stewart movies.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. But listen,
but it's not about Jimmy Stewart.
When you look at what occurs in the legislatures and in Congress, I'm telling you, they sit there and they are entitled after they've been there for a while.
I think it's that they're afraid.
It's not just that. It affects the legislation. It affects the corruption.
No, I'm you know, broadly speaking, I'm not disagreeing with you. Right. And I know that we've got some real flaming out of control egos in politics, and there are a lot of really good people. Our goal should be to get more good people and fewer of the flaming egos. But more importantly than that, our goal should be to get the money out of this thing. I mean, just consider, this election is probably going to be a $2 billion election. 4 years ago, it was $1 billion was spent. Most of it went to the media. Mm-hmm. So there's 150,000 or 150 million working families in the United States, or 115 million working families in the United States right now. If 115 million working families put in $2.50 a year, that means every 4 years there would be $1.5 billion. Mm-hmm. That's $5 a year from each working family.
You're saying Obama should give back part of the money.
I'm all in favor of public financing. I'm not going to say that because the system is corrupt right now. Uh-huh. If we fixed the system, if everybody simply checked the box and said, yes, I'll give $5, if, in fact, it wasn't optional, if everybody who files a tax return paid that $5, and then we say, okay, here's a pot of money. Well, we're doing this in Portland, Oregon. You know this.
And it doesn't work.
No, it works marvelously.
Horrible. The first thing they did, you know, the guys that did it right off are in jail.
No, the guys who tried to break it up are in jail. The conservatives who came in and tried, and the Russian mafia.
The Russian mafia. Yeah, they're the ones that are in jail. The first thing that they did was go for the dollars.
Right.
You know,
got busted.
There's no way that you can interpret
Look at the election with Eric Stan and Jenny Burdick. Here, Eric Stan was the guy who was running. He was a good guy. He was in favor of this. For our listeners who don't know, and Greg and I both live in Portland, so we're talking with Greg Clapper, national political consultant to mostly Republicans and Libertarians. And Eric put this thing through. If you get 1,000 people to give you $5 and sign a petition, the city gives you $100,000. If your competitor doesn't take that matching money, then Jenny didn't. Mm-hmm. She raised $100,000, right, and then the Enron subsidiary, PGE, I guess it was, somebody anyway, gave her another $20,000. I don't remember the exact amounts. You probably remember. And so the city had to match it.
Right.
And when the city matched it, it became a news story. Right. So when you've got somebody who's in the pocket of a big corporation, the extent to which they're in the pockets of the big corporation becomes a news story with public financing of elections. It worked. Now, you think it didn't work because Eric Sten won and Jenny Burdick lost.
No, I don't think it worked because there wasn't enough thought put into what the system was going to be. It took these people about 30 seconds to figure out if they faked a bunch of $5 checks.
But they got busted for it.
Yeah, of course. That's what I'm saying.
So it's not going to happen again. No, I see that as a success.
You end up with people in jail, and you're interpreting that as a good...
Well, when criminals are in jail, I consider that a success.
I don't want government involved anymore, in financing
elections. But government is us.
Right.
I mean, in the Soviet Union, in the old Soviet Union, government was them.
Right.
This is the United States of America. Our government is us. We shouldn't be involved in our elections?
We shouldn't be involved.
You think just General Electric
in providing money?
Just Enron
should
be?
The original concept was you go out as an individual or through your party, and you get like-minded people who will contribute to you, and you run accordingly.
Right.
Now, why are you going to, by the force of government, go in and take money out of people's pockets?
Because of Buckley versus Viejo and First National Bank versus Bilotti. You know this.
Right.
These two Supreme Court decisions that said corporations are persons. Corporations have the right to participate in elections. Corporations
but
can cost money.
Okay, then let's go back. Let's go to the Oregon example, okay? Who gives the most money by far to politics in Oregon? It isn't the corporations. The corporations are not the enemy. It's the weasels at the public employee unions.
Oh, come on. That's unions are democracies. These are the... Yeah. Stick a stake right at the end, Greg. You are so good at that. I love it. 45 minutes past the hour. Greg Clafford.
The Tom Hartman Program. Visit us on the web at hartmanradio.com.
Carried to the sea. Cause I'm a regular trouble gambler. I make my living on the run. I'm a regular trouble gambler. Big money will always be my home.
9.5 minutes before the hour. A couple of rather disturbing stories in the news I think are definitely worth sharing with you, aside from the Gestapo tactics taking place in Minnesota here. The owner of an independent website critical of authorities was shot and killed by police in southern Russia, his colleague said. We're seeing Russia, well, I'm not sure that it ever stopped being a police state, frankly. An official in Moscow confirmed the death of the owner of this website, Igushtia.ru. His name, Magomed Yevelovev. Police said police took Yevelov off a plane, arrested him, dumped him on the road with a gunshot wound to his head. Right. And in other police state news, the Dutch Intelligence Service, this is from the Jerusalem Post, actually. The Dutch Intelligence Service, the AIVD, has called off an operation aimed at infiltrating and sabotaging Iran's nuclear industry. Why? Due to an assessment that the Dutch intelligence service made that a U.S. attack on the Islamic Republic's nuclear program is imminent. So the report claimed that the Dutch operation had been extremely successful. The Dutch were basically, they had infiltrated Iran and they were going to sabotage this nuclear reactor. And they decided to pull out because they didn't want their guys who had infiltrated this reactor, they didn't want their guys to get killed when George Bush started dropping bombs on Iran. There is a lot of stuff going on in the world. I mean, this is downright bizarre. Mark in Los Angeles. Hey, Mark, what's on your mind today?
Hey, I want to wish everybody a happy Labor Day. I was sort of afraid that Gustav was going to take our attention away from it the way the Republican convention was trying to. But I'd like to talk about Walmart. I heard the other day that Walmart was taking out life insurance policies against its employees, and I just want to say that I think that means that the labor is worth more dead than alive to them.
And this sounds to me, by the way, Mark, it's not. Go ahead.
It sounds to me more like a kind of a capitalist holocaust that can happen when, you know, capitalism runs amok, as you mention often.
Yeah, and it's not just Walmart, by the way, Mark. Maybe 4 or 5 years ago, this got outed. It's something that's been going on for over a decade. Corporations taking out life insurance, particularly on their employees over 40 or over 50. And Walmart has more than a share of those. And they win if the guy dies, and the premiums are fairly low. So it's morbid is what it is. It's really morbid. Jeremy, Northampton, Mass. Hey, Jeremy.
Hey, how's it going there, Tom?
Two hot mics. Yeah, just fine. Just fine, Jeremy.
You know, I'm a huge fan of yours. I'm a longtime listener. And I can't believe that the first time I'm calling, I have to admonish you on something. It's the... It's the rhetoric that you were using with the anti-choice caller. I had just been lecturing my daughter on this the other day about the importance of framing an issue, and I was really shocked to hear you, you know, co-opting that terminology of pro-choice. Pro-life, which by implication means that I'm anti-life in some way. Because
on the other side suggests that the other side is anti-choice, which I guess they are. They're if the choice is abortion.
Well, that's right.
My point, though, and Jeremy, I get your point, and in fact, I've argued that point many times. My concern, though, is that there are a lot of Democrats. I'm not one of them. There are a lot of Democrats who are very concerned about abortion, who are opposed to it. Many of them are Catholic. Many of them are not. Many of them are Protestant fundamentalists. Many of them are not even religious. And if the party systematically excludes them, I think that it's going to have a problem, frankly. I mean, it's the bottom line. I'm just looking at how can this Democratic Party win as many House and Senate seats across the United States? Because at the end of the day, I mean, that is an important issue that we need to have a national dialogue on. And if the planet melts down with global warming, and if we engage in war with Iran, and if we end up in a nuclear war with Russia, it frankly is going to make the argument of pro-life, pro-choice look rather small.
Let me make a quick rejoinder to that.
Sure.
I would say that the counter to that is that the rhetoric of pro-life ignores the fact that that by and large these people tend to be to ignore the greater problems of life after birth. Okay, yeah. I don't have to lecture you about overpopulation.
No, and that was Janet. That was Janet's point: is that Democrats get that, and Democrats are the true pro-life party in that they're opposed to capital punishment. They're in favor of supporting babies after they're born. They're in favor of supporting people in their old age. The strong social security. They're in broadly across the realm. We need to recapture pro-life as a whole thing and not cede it to a small band of folks who are simply saying that it's only abortion. And by the way, they're all in gung ho in favor of executing criminals and having wars. That's not pro-life.
But you're arguing the wrong side, really, because in fact, it's possible to be entirely pro-life while still maintaining a woman's right to choose. And if you're going to tinker with
which
that,
is what I consider myself to be, by the way.
Well, you're going to force a woman to give birth. It's a horrible dystopian future you're suggesting. And
I'm not suggesting that future, first of all. But the point is that there are people in this party for whom that's a big deal. And I'm
investigate 9/11.
There you go, Jeremy. Thank you. Speaking of life, I mean, let's all investigate 9/11. It's 56 minutes past the hour. We'll be back. Tom Hartman here with you. Will we be back? This is the end of the show, isn't it? Holy cow, boy, did that go by fast. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Get out there. Get active. Confront a Republican today. Tag, you're it.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit HartmanRadio.com.